So the Dhamma for today is the ways of good karma and the ways of bad karma. The kusala kamapatha and the akusala kamapatha. So karma is obviously a very well-known aspect of the Buddha's teaching. And we have to understand, as always, that in Buddhism, karma really refers to the ethical quality of mind behind the actions. So the word karma means actions. So when we perform an action with a mind that is ethically charged, means it is a positive, a good mind, or it is a negative, a bad mind, a mind that is charged with some kind of emotion, whether it be a beneficial, a pure state of emotional state, or an impure emotional state, a state of unwholesomeness. The word kusala here, I translated generally as good. You know. The word kusala is an interesting word. There are other words that mean good, and when we think of good and bad karma in modern times, in non-Buddhist circles, when we talk about good karma, bad karma, by people who aren't really familiar with the deep teachings of the Buddha, they will be concerned with the results of karma. So when someone says you have good karma or you have bad karma, they're mostly referring to the effects. So if you have good karma, good things, it means you can notice that good things are happening to you. You must have done good things in the past, but the good karma means you have good results of the karma. And likewise, if someone is suffering, if someone is meeting with difficulties and challenges and stress and misfortune, we often say, oh, they must have very bad karma, you know, because we can see from the results that they must have done bad things in the past. But the word kusala here can be translated as good in a bit of a different way. Now, it can mean good in terms of wholesome, pure, the same as punya, as a pure state of mind or a goodness that you perform. When someone performs goodness, you can say kusala. And so akusala would be evil. But the word kusala more literally refers to one's proficiency. So you can say someone is good at something if they are kusala. It's not a common usage of the word in the text. Mostly the text does refer to ethical qualities. If you have an ethical state of mind, that is kusala. An unethical state of mind, that is akusala. But the usage of the word kusala, instead of some other word meaning good or evil, punya or papa or something, does present us with an interesting explanation of what it means to have truly good karma or bad karma. And the meaning is that someone who has good karma means they are good at karma. And they are good at performing, they are skilled at living. Their way of life, their way of behaving is proficient. So we can say someone who, we equate goodness, purity, and the wholesome qualities that we're cultivating in the Buddha's teaching with proficiency. We can look at evil people as being not very good at living their lives, not very skilled, not very competent. It's a unique and sort of refreshing way to think of evil, good and evil, when you think of evil people as just being not very good at living life. And the point is that as a result of those evil deeds, bad things are going to happen to them. So obviously they're not very good at living. They may seem very proud or very confident in their evil machinations, but when the results come, they are confronted with the fact that they have made big mistakes in their lives and they have been engaging in actions that are unskilled, and as a result harmful, and a cause of stress and suffering. So altogether there are 10 kusala kamapatta and 10 akusala kamapatta. And again, these are the actions, these are the deeds that one can perform. They are split up for ease of understanding into three groups. So there may be 10, and it may seem daunting to try and remember and keep track of all the many different ways of performing good and evil deeds. It's really quite simple. You can perform good deeds by physical action, so good deeds by body, and you can perform evil deeds by body. So the first category of deeds is bodily deeds. The second category is verbal deeds. You can perform actions, ethical actions with speech, unethical actions with speech. And the third category is mental. So though we normally think of actions as being something physical, something that you actually do, clearly there are states of mind and there are habits and ways of establishing one's mindset that is very clearly ethically charged and has very real consequences for one's future. So there are ethical mental actions and there are unethical mental actions. So really there are three ways of performing wholesome or unwholesome deeds, good or bad deeds, and three aspects of cultivating the skill in performing deeds, whether it's by body, by speech, or by mind. Not really a lot to think about. And then the details are just that. There are different ways that we can perform actions that are the cause of stress and suffering, and different ways we can perform actions that are the cause of happiness and peace. And so a big part or a way of looking at what we're cultivating through the practice of mindfulness or the practice of the Buddha's teaching in general is this cultivation of skill or proficiency, getting good at living our lives. When you look at the results of the cultivation of mindfulness, it's not the attainment of heaven or some blissful celestial palace. It's not riches or fame or spiritual power. It's proficiency. It's a clarity of mind that allows you to act in a way that is pure, speak in a way that is pure, and even think in a way that is efficient and proficient, and to your benefit and to the benefit of others. It helps you to weed out harmful actions, harmful habits that lead you to say and do and even think things that cause stress and suffering for yourself and others. So altogether there are 10, and again, these are the actual actions, and they aren't the very core essence of what it means to be ethical or unethical, but they are based on ethical and unethical qualities of mind. So you can't perform physical actions of an ethical quality without an ethical state of mind, meaning if you want to do something bad physically, you have to have a corrupt state of mind behind it. So these are the actual, what you could say, the outcome or the consequences of having unethical states of mind or ethical states of mind. Depending on the quality of your mind, you're going to act and you're going to speak and you're even going to think in certain ways as a result. And so on the one hand, we can look at these as things that we have to guard against and that mindfulness helps us to guard against. But on the other hand, we can think of them as the consequences of mindfulness and lack of mindfulness. If we're not mindful, the result will be unethical actions. If you are corrupt in the mind, then everything you do and say and even think will be corrupt. And likewise, if you cultivate mindfulness, if you cultivate purity of mind, then as a result, the things you do, the things you say, and even the things you think will be associated with that purity. So, going in order, there are three bodily karmas that are unethical and three that are ethical. The other thing we can say first is the ethical and the unethical, the good and the bad karma in this case, because we're talking about good as in terms of skill of living your life, they are parallel opposites. So the good karmas are simply the absence of the bad karmas, meaning if you consider yourself skilled or proficient or good at living your life, all you need to do is to free yourself or do away with all of the unwholesomeness, all of the unskillful actions and of body, speech and mind. Once you are free from those, there's nothing special that you need to do to perform good karma. This isn't like the good karma of giving charity or of being kind and generous and helpful to others, the good charity of cultivating meditation and so on. This is just the criteria for living a skilled life, which means the absence of unwholesome deeds. And so all of the wholesome, all of the good karma side of things, being good at acting, at living your life, is just the absence of the bad. So there are three bad that we try our best to free ourselves from, and that we work to free ourselves from through the practice of mindfulness. The first is killing. So the cornerstone of Buddhist ethics is non-violence, harmlessness, that we lay down the weapon, we lay down the rod, so they say, lay down the stick. We don't take up the stick, we don't threaten other beings with violence. And the first sign that someone is good at living their life is that they have given up killing, or that they are disinclined or averse or dedicated to not killing other living beings. Of course, killing is a is the extreme form of violence that you can perform on another. Killing is something that creates the utmost disruption to another being's life. Obviously, killing in a Buddhist sense doesn't actually end the existence of a being. It just ends the life, the present life that the individual is attached to, is identifying with. But at the moment of death, of course, there is future birth. The problem, of course, with killing is that it is disruptive. It is violent. It is unwelcome, it is unwanted, and it is a disturbance of the natural course of things, the natural working out of the being's karma. So even if someone were to engage in killing of a being that is suffering, so assisted suicide or euthanasia or that sort of thing, in Buddhism there's no defense for those sorts of activities because of the disruption that they bring, even if they are welcome. So suicide or assisted suicide are not wholesome or valuable or valid actions. They're not skillful actions, it's just unskillful. It means someone is bad at life if they engage in suicide or assisting others in suicide or euthanasia or that sort of thing, because they don't understand and they don't have a sense of the right way to deal with and to allow karma to work itself out. Killing is something that absolutely, there's never any excuse, there's no just killing or any sort of excuse for engaging in the killing of other living beings. The second is stealing. So obviously stealing is something that is fairly universally understood to be unethical. There are those who engage in it as a matter of as a means of livelihood, but in general stealing is easily understood as being unwholesome. But it should also be understood as being unskillful. A person who steals doesn't actually really benefit themselves. They corrupt their mind and they create a sense of deserved guilt for being a thief, for taking that which is not given, for depriving other people of their rightful property. It's something that stresses the mind and corrupts the mind. It is something that is a sign that you're not very good at living your life. You're not able to face the reality of poverty, face the reality of lack of wealth or not getting what you want. And so as a result, you break trust and you break ethical boundaries to take the possessions of others. So the good karma is simply to avoid stealing. All you have to do to be good at life in this matter is to give up stealing, to never take what is not given, even when you are desperate, and to try and face and confront the reality of your situation, as opposed to trying to cheat or find ways to manipulate your situation for your own short-term material gain. Whatever situation we find ourselves in is a cause of or as a result of the past causes of what we've done. And so facing it is a very important part of gaining perspective and understanding and changing our path in life. The third bad karma physically is sensual misconduct. So the engaging in unwholesome sensuality. But any kind of sensuality from a Buddhist perspective is technically unwholesome. Those are the unwholesome states of mind that lead to breaking these rules. But this one refers specifically to cheating, to breaking again the ethical boundaries that relate to trust and the expectations that other people have on us, boundaries of permission and consent and so on. So this refers to romance and sexuality, engaging in the actions of cheating, adultery, breaking up the relationships of others, going beyond the reasonable boundaries of sensuality. So whereas in Buddhism we can understand that any kind of attachment or greed or desire is going to cause stress and suffering, it has dangers and disadvantages. What's being talked about here is the result or the extreme of those sorts of lustful, passionate, or greed-based states of mind, which are the engagement of in crossing boundaries and creating suffering as a result of coveting other people's relationships, or breaking up other people's relationships, or coveting those outside of your relationship, committing adultery and that sort of thing. So those three are the three physical forms of unskillful conduct. Obviously there are many other things that we can do physically that are a source of stress and suffering and a cause for bad karma, as it were. These are more of a guideline or more of the extreme, and everything else can be seen to sort of fit in with these. So there's other kinds of violence, of course, that don't result in killing, but they're still in line with the idea behind killing. And also you can say that even when we engage in violence, as long as we don't engage in killing, then we can still be redeemed. And it's still not something that you could think is really going to be irredeemable. It's something that is a natural part of ordinary life, where people are from time to time violent with each other. And though it's not excusable and it's terribly unwholesome, it's still not on the level of actual murder. No. So it's something that is easier to come back from. And nonetheless, if we're going to look at this honestly, any kind of physical activity that's associated with unwholesomeness can be considered unwholesome physical or bad physical actions, bad bodily karma. So if you walk stomping around the house with anger, if you kick a chair or a table out of, or a wall out of anger, punch a wall when people punch a hole in a wall, even though no one is hurt as a result, it's still incredibly unwholesome. It's a bad habit, and it's going to be a cause not just of immediate suffering, but of long-term bad habits of stress, and can even cause great mental torture as a result, and can still be considered, should still be considered, unwholesome physical karma. And so you can see this one of the examples of how mindfulness is so helpful, so beneficial to us in our lives, as a result of cultivating or developing the skill of being mindful in our physical actions, when we walk, when we talk, when we stand, when we sit, when we act, when we work, when we play, and everything that we do, when we cultivate mindfulness, when we try to be present and aware, we're able to free ourselves from the dangers of these unrefined coarse states of behavior. Our bodily activities become very refined and pure. And so when we walk mindfully. When we stand mindfully. When we work, when we clean, when we live our lives in a way that is free from the dangers of unethical states of mind. The body is a great way of cultivating purity of mind. When you focus on the body, like in walking meditation, you can see how it allows you to purify the mind as a result through the focus on the movements of the body. So the second set is speech. Now, physical actions are more coarse and more easily guarded against. It's something that we have to spend time guarding against, but still fairly trivial to avoid killing and stealing and cheating. You know, as long as someone is reasonably mindful, they're able to avoid these, generally speaking. Speech is more challenging, and one of the reasons why we encourage meditators to speak very little or to speak only when is necessary is because of how dangerous it is and how polluting it can be to engage in over speaking, you know, excessive verbal activity. There are four kinds of bad speech that are a sign that someone is not very skilled in speaking. Speech that leads to stress and suffering, leads to negative consequences, and is in general very real and very clear examples of bad karma. The first is false speech, lying. Lying is really the worst. It's in a category of its own. Of all the types of speech that you can perform, it's by far the worst. It's the one which has the most devastating consequences. When you lie, you pervert reality. You deprive someone else of access to the truth, access to facts. As we saw earlier, it's one of the mala, one of the nine stains on someone's character. Someone who lies cannot be trusted, should not be trusted, and will find themselves in difficulty making friendships and keeping deep and lasting and trusting friendships as a result of their habit of distorting or depriving other people of the truth. It's also the opposite of what we try to accomplish through the practice of mindfulness. Mindfulness, the idea is to bring you closer to the truth. So if you have a habit or if you're inclined to distort or move away from the truth or avoid the truth, you're never going to be, it's going to be adverse and antithetical to what you're trying to cultivate in mindfulness. So from a Buddhist perspective, it's devastating. And perfectly antithetical to the goal of the Buddhist teaching. But the other three are equally we have to guard against. They're more difficult, but also good reason to be very careful in how we engage in speech. The second is pisunawaja, which means gossiping, more specifically backbiting. Speaking badly about other people behind their backs. Speech that is designed to create division. So gossiping about others as a means of giving them a bad reputation. Telling other people, giving bad opinions of other people to taint their view of them. Telling someone how someone else is a bad person or not worth their association or so on. Doing what you can to cultivate division, painting people in a bad light, pointing out people's flaws, focusing on their flaws, criticizing them, and telling tales about things that they have done, mistakes they have made, and putting them in a light that makes them look bad. A common thing that is a clear indication that someone's not very good at living there, not very good at speech, that they're engaging in speech that is not skillful, that is not proficient, that has no good benefit, obviously. Division creates disharmony, and when you think you're going to benefit, all you're doing is creating stress and suffering, and you're not creating any sense of trust or respect. No one can respect someone who willingly defames other people behind their backs or sows discord between friends and that sort of thing. This isn't the basis for good friendship. If you're gossiping about other people, then everyone will think that maybe you're gossiping about them as well. They come to think of you as a gossip, as someone who delights in discord. And so obviously this is detrimental and antithetical to the teaching of the Buddha, which works for harmony, harmony between individuals, but also harmony in one's mind, mental harmony, qualities of mind that are strong and don't need to belittle others or talk down to others or destroy other people's reputations. It's obviously very unwholesome, very impure behavior, and a sign of lack of proficiency and just not being very good at speech. So if someone is, it means that someone is still unskilled if they are resorting to these kinds of speech. The third kind of speech is harsh speech. So this is to someone's face, insulting them, criticizing them, scolding them, defaming, any kind of speech that is meant to hurt the person who you're speaking to. Speech that insults them, speech that manipulates their emotions, speech that triggers them, that is designed to trigger them, designed to make them upset, designed to make them sad, designed to hurt and wound them. This kind of speech often comes up in the heat of the moment, where a good person or a generally good person might get angry and say something they regret. You know, there are, of course, people who delight in insulting others, delight in criticism and this delight in insult, delight in harsh speech. But it's for those who are generally good people, it's something that we just have to guard against. This is why anger is so dangerous. Once you're angry, your whole manner of action, manner of speech changes. You can perform unwholesome bodily actions very easily and unwholesome physical, verbal actions very quickly. Speech is something that's very difficult to guard when your emotions take over. Greed can lead you to lie or manipulate others. Anger can lead you to lie or manipulate others. You know, these very quickly, these emotions lead to verbal misconduct. So our speech is a good indicator of our state of mind, and obviously someone who is insulting others, who is unpleasant in their speech, is not speaking things that are delightful, speech that is pleasant. In general, someone who doesn't generally engage in pleasant speech is probably not someone who is very skilled in their qualities of mind, let alone their activities of speech. And the fourth type of bad speech is sampapalapa, which means useless speech or meaningless speech. This is definitely the most difficult. This is something that only an arahant can be truly free from. And it's a big reason why, again, we encourage meditators to engage in very little speech as necessary, because a lot of our speech just becomes superfluous, meaningless, and distracting. The more you speak, the more your mind becomes active, and so engaging in speech that is unrelated to mindfulness, unrelated to the Buddha's teaching, leads very much to distracted scattered state of mind, a mind that is not focused, a mind that is not strong, a mind that is not at peace. So speech about politics, speech about worldly affairs, speech about unnecessary things, just unnecessary speech in general. How much of our speech is just meant to fill the silence? Yeah. How much of our speech is really just useless, meaningless, pointless? Even saying something at the wrong time is still useless speech. If you don't know the right time to say something, you really shouldn't. You should. It's a sign that you're not very good, not very skilled at, not very mindful. And so your speech suffers as a result of the lack of mindfulness. You wind up saying things that are unnecessary, saying things that are distracting to others, saying things that are trying to other people's patience, and so on. So our speech should be succinct, it should be to the point, it should be focused. Most importantly, it should be based on mindfulness. If you're cultivating mindfulness, your speech will be a reflection of that. As a result of a mindful state of mind, your speech will be focused, it will be to the point, it will be pertinent, it will be useful, and it will be the bare minimum necessary to get the point across. So these are the four types of speech. Again, speech is something that is difficult to moderate. It's easy to get lost in speech, and if your emotions take over, it's easy for your speech to spill over into lying or gossiping or harsh speech or most definitely useless speech. So it's a good example of how mindfulness is so valuable, and it's a good example of how mindfulness is so important. And it's also a reminder of the things we have to be careful about in order to support our mindfulness, because it goes both ways. Mindfulness changes your behavior and your speech, but if you behave and speak and act and speak in ways that are unethical, your mindfulness will suffer as a result if you're not careful with your actions and speech. So that's body and speech. The third is mind. So mental karma is something that is probably fairly uniquely Buddhist. There are other hints of it in other religious teachings and spiritual teachings. But of course, this is the hallmark of the Buddhist teaching, that actions and ethical qualities are based in the mind. Everything starts from the mind. You know, the first of the Dhammapada is Manopubangama Dhamma, the mind comes first. So again, all of our activities that are ethical or unethical are going to be based on some quality of mind that is ethical or unethical. But those qualities are not specifically what we're talking about here. What we're talking about here is the determination in the mind, the fixing of the mind in a specific direction. So the first one is abhijja, which does literally mean something like greed or desire. But here it isn't just any state of greed or any state of desire. It is when states of desire, wanting or liking something, lead you to be greedy. So abhijja is a greedy state of mind, when you are very much fixated on something, when you have need, when you yearn for something, when you're obsessed with something. So any kind of physical, sensual desire, and even the desire to become something, to be rich or to be famous or to go to heaven, desire to obtain the objects of your desire, to obtain a relationship, or the desire to be free from something, any kind of greed where your mind becomes greedy, as in going beyond the boundaries of ordinary desire. So ordinary people, it's reasonable for them to want good food and good sights and sounds and smells and tastes. In general, we prefer these things, and the preference is based on desire, based on greed. It's unwholesome, and it's inefficient, it's impure, it would be better to be done away with, but it doesn't really cross a line whereby you can say this person is greedy, or this person is likely to go to an unwholesome or an unpleasant destination when they die as a result of their greed. So when someone is consumed by greed, this is abhijja. This is something that we have to guard against, and it's the result, it's the consequence of not paying attention to your desire. When you have desire and you allow it to grow and burn up and consume your mind, this is the result, as someone becomes obsessed and in need of things in order to be happy. The opposite is bhayapada, the next akusala kamapada. So bhayapada means ill will. And so the opposite of abhijja, when you desire or crave or yearn for something, abhijja is when you are averse to something. Bhayapada is when you're averse to something, when you're angry about something. But it's not just the anger. Bhayapada means ill will, and that you really wish harm to come to someone else, or you wish for destruction to something, where you have intense enough dislike that you have wishes for harm to come When you wish harm on others, you wish for them to suffer, you yearn for their suffering, or you're consumed by fantasies about a person suffering. Any kind of ill will thought of imagining yourself hurting other people, even imagining yourself saying mean things to them, things that are harmful, things that are painful for them to hear, doing things to harm other people. Any kind of ill will of this sort obviously is unwholesome, but we can also say it's karma. It really is a very significant and substantial form of activity. It closes so many doors that could lead to harmony and peace and happiness. When you are angry at someone, it destroys your relationship with them. It prevents you from creating harmony and intimacy, and prevents you from creating friendship and maintaining friendships. If you allow anger to consume you and you hold a grudge and it becomes hatred, and obviously there is real great danger, not just in this present life of causing disharmony and conflict, but also of consuming you to the point where you perform unwholesome karmas, hurting or saying or speaking harsh speech, and even eventually being consumed by the anger to the extent that you, when you die, you're reborn in an unpleasant destination or even hell. And the final bad karma the third from the mental perspective, is wrong view. And we talked about wrong view. Wrong view is the worst of the worst, because of how it changes and distorts the way that you look at everything. It changes the way you act, it changes the way you speak. If you have wrong view, it's going to dictate your behavior and dictate your speech. It's going to dictate the path that you carve out in your life, in a bad way, because it's wrong, because it's out of line with reality. Wrong view means views that are out of line with the nature of reality. And when that is the case, when you have a perspective, when you look at things in a way that is just out of line with the way they actually are, and you have a view or the belief that they are that way, then that belief is going to be very strong aspect, or strong, very important part in how play an important part in how you interact with the world around you, and it's going to corrupt your actions and your speech and your engagement, your interactions with the world in general. Wrong view is based on delusion, so it's the consequence of delusion. And it's a good example, again, of how powerful and valuable and important mindfulness is. Because without mindfulness, it's hard to say whether your views are going to be right or wrong. When you're in darkness, you might guess where the objects in a room are, or you might guess what your surrounding environment is, but you might be right and you might be wrong, and your chances of being right are obviously far less than your chances of being wrong. And the chances of hurting yourself and causing harm to yourself and others is quite significant. So wrong view is the consequence of this darkness, the consequence of this lack of clarity and purity of mind. And as a result of being mindful, it's like we're seeking out the light, or we're cultivating within ourselves the light to see, and to see things as they actually are, to clear up our wrong views, to dispel even any chance of wrong view from arising, because we see with our own eyes the way things are. So any view that is out of line with the way things are doesn't have a chance to grow and is unable to take root, because it's it's in dissonance with our perception of reality. Of course, if you don't look, if you don't pay attention, if you don't cultivate mindfulness, then it's very much up in the air as to whether you're going to find the right way. It's very unlikely that you will be able to find the right way to go, or the right way to speak or to act, or even to think in a very sustainable or meaningful way, because of the darkness, because of the lack of clarity. And so it's very easy and likely that you're going to stumble upon wrong view and wrong ideas about reality that end up causing you stress or suffering. So these 10 akusala kamapata, these are the bad karmas. And again, their opposites are the good karma. All you have to do to be skilled in karma is to free yourself from these 10 things. And so these can be seen again as things that we should guard against, be wary of, and work to weed out in ourselves, and also should be seen as the consequences of lack of clarity, lack of mindfulness, and rejoice in the benefits of mindfulness as a result of cultivating clarity of mind and purity of mind. We free ourselves from so many mistakes that we could possibly make, and we can see the very sort of basic nature of these karmas, and be reassured and be pacified in our worry about whether we're a good person or a bad person. And so there's not a lot that you have to think about in terms of understanding whether you're a good person or a bad person, and a lot of the details of life that make us worry or make us think that maybe we're a bad person or maybe we're on the wrong path are dispelled when we understand this very simple teaching as being the very basis and the most important criteria to consider when thinking about whether we're a good person or a bad person. If you are free from these 10 akusala kamapata, then you can consider yourself in general to be at least capable of becoming a good person. If on the other hand you find yourself regularly engaging in one or many of these unskilled, these bad karmas, then you have to be concerned that you might be a bad person, or you're a person who is bad at life, who is unskilled, that you need training, and you're in need of the cultivation of the skills of mindfulness and the skills of the mental skills that allow you to act ethically and speak ethically and think ethically. So that's the Dhamma for today.